The Castle by Franz Kafka, concluded. Disc 9. Hadn't he had a feeling of grave impropriety there in the corridor? But if that were so, how could he have hung around there like an animal in pasture? Hadn't he been called to a nighttime interrogation, and did he not know why nighttime interrogations had been introduced? The sole purpose of the nighttime interrogations, and here Kay received a new explanation of what they meant, was to ensure that those parties whom the gentleman couldn't stand to see by day were quickly examined at night under artificial light, so the gentleman would get a chance right after the hearing to forget all that ugliness in their sleep. But Kay's behaviour had made a mockery of all of the measures. Even ghosts disappear toward morning, but Kay had remained there with his hands in his pockets, as though he expected that since he was not going away, the entire corridor with all the rooms and gentlemen would go away instead. And this would certainly have happened, he could be sure of this, had it been at all possible, for the gentleman's delicacy of feeling was boundless. Nobody would, for instance, drive Kay away, or even tell him what was so obvious, namely that he should finally go. Nobody would do so, even though they probably trembled with excitement while Kay was around, and so the morning, their favourite time, was spoiled for them. Rather than take action against Kay, they preferred to suffer, though no doubt partly in hopes that Kay would finally have to recognise the most glaringly obvious thing, and would have to suffer in a way that matched the gentleman's sufferings by being obliged to stand in the corridor in the morning, so terribly out of place, so visible to all. Vain hope! They don't know, or in their friendliness and disdain don't want to know, that there are insensitive, hard hearts that cannot be softened even by reverence. Does not even the night moth, poor creature, when day comes, seek a quiet corner and flatten itself out, preferring to disappear and unhappy that it cannot? Kay, by contrast, goes and stands where he is most visible, and if in this way he could prevent the day from dawning, he would do so. He cannot prevent that, but unfortunately he can postpone it and make it more difficult. Didn't he watch the files being distributed? Something that nobody was allowed to watch, except for the immediate participants? Something that the landlord and the landlady weren't even allowed to watch in their own house? About which they had heard only a few hints, such as today, for instance, from the servant? So he hadn't noticed the difficulties under which the distribution of files had taken place, which were actually incomprehensible, for after all, each gentleman serves only the cause, never thinks of personal gain, and therefore had to work with all his strength to ensure that the distribution of files, this important, essential work, proceed quickly, easily, and without error? And had it really never even remotely dawned on Kay that the main thing about all the difficulties was that the distribution had to be carried out with the doors almost closed, without the possibility of direct contact between the gentlemen, who could, of course, signal to one another in a flash, whereas the distribution through the servants necessarily has to go on for hours, can never take place without complaints, is a constant source of torment to the gentlemen and to the servants, and will probably have harmful consequences for the work later on? And why couldn't the gentlemen have any contact with one another? So Kay didn't understand this yet? Nothing like this had ever happened to the landlady. The landlord confirmed that this was also true of him, though they had had to deal with quite a few unruly people. Things that otherwise one didn't dare to say had to be said to him openly, for otherwise he did not understand the most important point. Well now, since it had to be said, because of him, simply and solely because of him, the gentlemen couldn't emerge from their rooms, for early in the morning, shortly after sleep, they are too modest, too vulnerable to be able to expose themselves to the eyes of strangers. They feel too bare, even if they're completely dressed, to show themselves. It's certainly hard to say why they're ashamed. Perhaps they're ashamed, these eternal workers, simply because they have slept. But perhaps they are even more ashamed of seeing strangers than of being seen. The very thing that they had happily overcome with the help of the nighttime interrogations, namely the sight of the parties, whom they find hard to stand, they do not want intruding on them in the morning, suddenly, abruptly, in all of nature's truth. They are simply not up to that. What kind of person would fail to respect this? Well, it could only be a person like Kay, somebody who puts himself above everything, above the law, and above the most ordinary human consideration with that stolid indifference and drowsiness of his, who doesn't care that he not only makes it impossible for the files to be distributed and damages the reputation of the inn, and who brings about an entirely unprecedented situation, namely that the gentlemen, who have been reduced to despair, begin to fight, and after an inner struggle inconceivable to ordinary people, reach for the bell and call for help in order to drive away the otherwise unshakable Kay. They, the gentlemen, call for help. Wouldn't the landlord and the landlady and their entire staff have come running over a long time ago if they had only dared to appear unsolicited before the gentleman in the morning, even if only to bring help and then to disappear at once? Trembling with outrage at Kay, inconsolable because of their impotence, they had waited here at the entrance to the corridor, and the utterly unexpected ringing had been like a deliverance for them. Now the worst was over. But if only they could steal a look at the joyous antics of the gentleman who had been finally liberated from Kay. But this wasn't the end of it for Kay, for he would certainly have to answer for what he had gone and done here. They had meanwhile reached the taproom. Why the landlord, angry though he was, had brought Kay here wasn't entirely clear. Perhaps he had actually noticed that right now Kay's weariness made it impossible for him to leave the inn. Without waiting for an invitation to sit down, Kay literally sank onto one of the barrels. It felt good to be in the dark. In this large room there was only a single weak electric bulb burning over the beer taps. Outside, too, it was still completely dark, and there seemed to be snow flurries. Once inside in the warmth, one had to be grateful and make sure one would not be thrown out. The landlord and the landlady were still standing in front of him, as though he actually posed a certain threat, as though one could not rule out the possibility, given his utter unreliability, that he would suddenly jump up and attempt to invade the corridor again. Besides, they themselves were tired after the night-time fright and the early rising, especially the landlady, who wore a rustling, silk-like, carelessly buttoned and tied full-skirted brown dress. Where had she found it in the rush? And, resting her head as if it had snapped upon her husband's shoulder, she dabbed her eyes with an elegant little handkerchief while now and then aiming childishly nasty looks at Kay. In order to calm the couple, Kay said that everything they had just told him was completely new to him, but that though he had not known about that, he hadn't wanted to stay so long in the corridor, where he really had nothing to do, and certainly hadn't wanted to torment anybody. All this had happened merely because of his extreme weariness. He thanked them for putting a stop to that embarrassing scene. If he were called to account, he would welcome the opportunity, for only in that way could he ensure that his conduct would not be generally misinterpreted. Only weariness was to blame. But this weariness came from his still not being used to the strain of the interrogations. After all, he hadn't been here all that long. Once he had more experience at this, nothing like that would ever be possible again. Perhaps he was taking the interrogations too seriously, but that alone was hardly a drawback. He had had to go through two interrogations, one shortly after the other, the first with Burgle and the other with Erlanger. The first especially had exhausted him, but the second hadn't lasted long. Erlanger had simply asked him for a favour, but the two together were more than he could bear at once. Perhaps this sort of thing would also be too much for anybody, for instance, the landlord. After the second interrogation, all he managed to do was stagger out. It had almost been a sort of drunkenness. That was the first time he had seen and heard the two gentlemen, and he also had to come up with answers for them. So far as he knew, everything had turned out rather well. But then there had occurred that misfortune which, after what had happened earlier, they could scarcely blame him for. Unfortunately, only Erlanger and Burgle had known about his condition, and would certainly have taken care of him and averted everything that had subsequently occurred. But Erlanger had had to leave right after the interrogation, evidently to go to the castle, and Burgle, probably exhausted from that same interrogation, so how could Kay have survived it without weakening, had fallen asleep and even slept right through the distribution of the files. Had Kay been given a similar opportunity, he would have used it with pleasure and gladly given up all forbidden glimpses, and this all the more readily, given that he had been in such a state that he couldn't see anything, so even the most sensitive gentleman could have appeared before him without fear. The mentioning of both interrogations, especially that of Erlanger, and the respect with which Kay had spoken of the gentleman, made the landlord more favourably disposed toward him. He already seemed prepared to fulfil Kay's request for permission to put a board over the barrels and to sleep there, at least until dawn. The landlady clearly opposed that, and, vainly tugging here and there at her dress, which she had only just noticed was in disarray, shook her head repeatedly. A seemingly long-standing quarrel about the cleanliness of the house was about to break out. To Kay, in his weariness, the couple's conversation seemed far more significant than usual. Being driven away from here seemed to him a misfortune that surpassed everything he had experienced up to now. That must not be allowed to happen, even if the landlord and landlady were to be united against him. Kay lay in wait, doubled up on the barrel, watching the two of them. Until the landlady, who with her usual sensitivity, which had struck Kay a long time ago, suddenly stepped aside and, most likely she had begun talking to the landlord about other matters, cried, "See how he's looking at me. It's about time you sent him away." But Kay, seizing this opportunity, for by now he was absolutely confident, even almost to the point of indifference, that he would stay, said, "I'm not looking at you, only at your dress." "Why my dress?" asked the landlady, agitated. Kay shrugged. "Come," said the landlady to the landlord. "He must be drunk, the lout. We'll let him sleep off his stupor here." And she gave an order that Peppy, who had, at a call from her, appeared out of the dark, unkempt, tired, casually holding a broom, should throw Kay a cushion. Chapter 25. When Kay awoke, he thought at first that he had barely slept. The room had not changed. It was empty and warm. The walls in the dark, a single light bulb over the beer taps, and outside the windows too, night. But when he stretched out, the pillow fell to the floor, and the board and barrels creaked. Peppy came at once, and he learned that it was already late evening, and that he had slept for well over 12 hours. The landlady had asked for him several times during the day, as had Gerstecker, who had waited here in the dark in the morning over a beer while Kay spoke with the landlady, but then hadn't dared to disturb Kay, had since come back once looking for Kay, and finally even Frida had supposedly come in and had stood for a moment beside Kay. Still, she had scarcely come because of Kay, but rather because she had to get some things ready here, for this evening she was supposed to take up her old duties again. "So she doesn't like you any more?" Peppy asked, while bringing him coffee and cake. Yet she didn't ask maliciously, as she used to do, but sadly, as though she had meanwhile become acquainted with the malice of the world, in the face of which all one's own malice gives way and becomes meaningless. She spoke to Kay as though to a fellow sufferer, and when he was sipping the coffee and she thought she saw it wasn't sweet enough for him, she ran to get him a full sugar bowl. Still, her sadness hadn't prevented her from prettying herself perhaps even more today than last time. She had a wealth of bows and ribbons, which were plaited through her hair, and along the forehead and temples her hair had been carefully crimped, and around her neck she wore a small chain, which hung down into the low neckline of her blouse. which wasn't necessarily an insane idea of Pepe's, for she was certainly well able to compete with Frida, one girl against another, nobody could deny it. And it was above all else Frida's position and the brilliance that Frida had been able to give it that had blinded Kay just then. And then Pepe had dreamed that once she had the position, Kay would come and plead with her, and then she would have the choice of either granting Kay's plea and losing the post, or rejecting him and climbing higher. And she had planned to give up everything and to go down to him and to teach him the true love that he could never experience with Frida and that is independent of every position of honour in the world. But that is not what happened. And what was to blame for that? Kay above all, and then of course Frida's slyness. Kay above all, for what does he want and what sort of strange person is he? What is he striving for? What are the important things that make him so preoccupied and make him forget what is nearest and best and most beautiful? Pepe is sacrificed, and everything is idiotic, and everything is lost, and anybody who had the strength to set the entire gentleman's inn on fire and burn it down without leaving a trace, to burn it up like a sheet of paper in a stove, today he would be Pepe's chosen one. Well, so Pepe came to the taproom. It was 4 days ago, shortly before lunch. The work here isn't easy. It is almost murderous work, but then the things to be gained aren't insignificant either. Pepe hadn't simply lived from day to day before that, and in her wildest thoughts she would never have claimed this post for herself. But she had already made numerous observations, knew what was involved in the post, and hadn't taken it on unprepared. You certainly couldn't take it on unprepared, for if you did, you would lose it in the first hour or two. Even if you were willing to conduct yourself like the chambermaids here. As a chambermaid, you do, after a while, feel quite lost and forgotten. It's like working in a mine, at least it's like that in the secretary's corridor. For days you see nobody other than the odd daytime parties, who flit about and don't dare look up. Nobody, except for two or three other chambermaids, and they are just as embittered. In the morning you aren't even allowed out of your room. The secretaries want to be left to themselves. The domestics carry in their meals from the kitchen. The chambermaids usually don't have anything to do with that, and during mealtimes they aren't even allowed to appear in the corridor. It's only while the gentlemen are at work that the chambermaids are allowed to tidy up. Though not, of course, in the occupied rooms, but only in those that happen to be empty, and that work must be done very quietly so that the gentleman's work is not disturbed. But how is it possible to tidy up quietly if the gentlemen occupy the rooms for days at a time, and what's more, if the domestics, that dirty riffraff, also go about their business in there so that when the room finally is turned over to the chambermaids, it is in such a state that not even the flood could make it clean? Truly, they are high-ranking gentlemen, but you have to struggle hard to overcome your revulsion in order to be able to tidy up after them. The chambermaids really don't have too much work, but it is strenuous. And never a kind word. Nothing but constant reproaches, especially this, the most tormenting and most frequent of them all, that in the course of the tidying up, files have been lost. In reality, nothing is ever lost. Every scrap of paper is handed to the landlord, but files naturally do get lost, only not by the girls. And then commissions come, and the girls have to leave their room while the commission is rummaging through their beds. Of course, the girls don't have any possessions, their few things fit in a rucksack, but the commission searches for hours all the same. Of course, it doesn't find anything. How could files possibly end up there? What interest could girls have in files? Once again, though, the only results are the insults and threats conveyed by the disappointed commission through the landlord. And never any peace, not by day, not by night. Noise half night long, and noise from earliest morning. If only one didn't have to live there, but one must, for in between mealtimes it's the chambermaid's job to go and get little things from the kitchen when given the order, especially at night. Always the sudden banging of a fist on the chambermaid's door, the dictating of the order, the rushing down to the kitchen, the shaking of the sleeping kitchen lads out of their sleep, the placing of the tray with the things that have been ordered outside the chambermaid's door, where the domestics pick it up. How sad all of this is. But that isn't the worst thing. The worst thing, rather, is when we get no orders. Deep at night, sometimes at a time when everybody should be asleep and most people are finally asleep, something or other starts creeping about outside the chambermaid's door. Then the girls climb out of their beds. The beds are arranged one above the other. There is really very little space. The entire maid's room is actually no more than a large cabinet with three compartments. Listen at the door, kneel down, and embrace one another in fear. And all this time you can hear the prowler at the door. By now everyone would be glad if he would finally come in, but nothing happens. Nobody comes in. And you have to remind yourself that there doesn't have to be any danger lurking there. Maybe it's only someone walking to and fro outside the door, wondering whether or not to place an order, and in the end unable to decide to do so. Maybe that's all it is, but maybe it's something quite different. Actually, you don't even know the gentlemen. You have barely seen them. In any case, the girls inside are dying of fright, and when it has finally become quiet outside, they lean against the wall and don't have the strength to climb back into their beds. That life again awaits Peppy. This very evening she's supposed to take up her old place in the chambermaid's room again. And why? Because of Kay and Frida. Back to the life she's barely fled, not only with the help of Kay, but also through great efforts of her own. For while serving there, the girls neglect their appearance, even those who are most careful otherwise. Who should they pretty themselves for? Nobody sees them, at most the kitchen staff. Anybody happy with that is perfectly free to pretty herself. For the rest, though, to have to be constantly in their small room, or in the gentlemen's rooms, which is silly and a waste to enter even just with clean clothes on. And always in that artificial light and stuffy air, the stove is constantly lit, and certainly always tired. The best way to spend the one free afternoon in the week is to sleep through it in some pantry off the kitchen, calmly and fearlessly. So why pretty oneself? You barely even get dressed. And then, all of a sudden, Peppy was transferred to the taproom, where, if you wanted to establish yourself, precisely the opposite was needed, where you were constantly being observed by people, including some quite spoiled and attentive gentlemen, so you always had to be as refined and pleasant-looking as possible. Well, that was quite a change. And Peppy may say of herself that she spared no effort. What would happen later on was of no concern to Peppy. She knew that she had the qualities needed for this post, was quite certain of it, and still had that belief, which nobody can take from her, not even today, on the day of her defeat. Only having to prove herself in the early days, that was difficult, because she was, after all, only a poor chambermaid without clothes or jewels, and because the gentleman hadn't the patience to wait and see how you turn out, but wanted a barmaid right away, without any gap, as is only appropriate, for they turn aside if that isn't the case. One might think their demands weren't all that great, for after all even Frida could satisfy them. But that is not so. Peppy often thought about this, often got together with Frida, and for a time even slept with her. It is not easy to figure out Frida, and anybody who doesn't pay close attention, well, do any of the gentlemen pay close attention, is immediately misled by her. Nobody realizes as keenly as Frida herself how wretched she looks. The first time you see her letting down her hair, say, you clutch your hands with pity. And if everything were done by rights, a girl of that sort should not even be a chambermaid. She knows it too, and many nights she wept over it, pressed herself up against Peppy, and wound Peppy's hair around her own head. But when she's on duty, all her doubts disappear. She thinks she's the most beautiful of all, and knows how to convince everybody of that. She understands people, and that is her true skill, and is quick to lie and deceive so that people don't have time to take a closer look at her. Of course, in the long run, that isn't enough. People do have eyes, and in the end they would be proved right. But no sooner has she noticed this kind of danger than she comes up with some other measure, most recently, for instance, her relationship with Clam. Her relationship with Clam. If you don't believe that, you can always check. Go to Clam and ask him. How sly. Oh, how sly. And if, say, you don't dare to go to Clam with a question like that, and if you aren't admitted with some infinitely more important questions, and Clam shuts himself off completely from you, only from you and people of your sort, since Frida, for instance, skips in to see him whenever she likes, if that is so, then you can still check the matter. All you need do is wait. Clam won't be able to tolerate such a false rumour for long. He must, after all, be wildly eager to discover what is being said about him in the taproom and in the public rooms. All this is of the greatest importance to him, and if it's wrong, then he will correct it at once. But he hasn't corrected it, so it doesn't need to be corrected. It is the utter truth. All you actually see is Frida taking beer into Clam's room and then coming out with the payment. But Frida describes what one cannot see, and one has to take her at her word. But she doesn't even describe it. She isn't about to blurt out secrets like that, no. All around her the secrets blurt out on their own, and once they're blurted out, she herself no longer hesitates to talk about them, modestly, without making claims, referring only to matters that are already common knowledge. But not to everything. Not, for instance, to the fact that ever since she came to the taproom, Clam has been drinking less beer than he used to. Not a great deal less, but clearly less all the same. She says nothing about this. Well, there may be various reasons for that. Beer has lost its appeal for Clam just now, or maybe he even forgot all about beer drinking over Frida. So at any rate, however astonishing this may seem, Frida is Clam's mistress. How could anything that is good enough for Clam fail to draw admiration from the others? And so, before you know what is happening, Frida has become a great beauty, a girl who is made to fit the needs of the taproom and is almost too beautiful, too powerful. But now the taproom is barely good enough for her. And people even find it odd that she's still in the taproom. To be a barmaid is no small thing. From that point of view, her relationship with Clam seems quite credible. But once the barmaid has become Clam's mistress, why does he leave her in the taproom, especially so long? Why doesn't he lead her higher? One can say to people 1,000 times that there's no contradiction here, that Clam has definite reasons for acting like this, or that Frida will be raised all of a sudden, perhaps even in the very near future. But this has barely any effect. People have definite ideas, and in the end they refuse to let sleight of hand of any kind distract them from them. Nobody even doubted any more that Frida is the mistress of Clam. Even those who obviously knew better had become too tired to doubt it. "In the name of the devil be Clam's mistress," they were thinking. "But if you are that already, we want to see signs of it in your rising up." But they saw no such signs, and Frida remained in the taproom, and secretly she was even quite happy that everything remained as it was. But she lost prestige among the people. This couldn't, of course, have escaped her notice. She usually notices things even before they happen. A really charming, beautiful girl, once settled in the taproom, doesn't have to use tricks. So long as she is beautiful, barring some particularly unfortunate coincidence, she will remain a barmaid. But a girl like Frida has to worry constantly about her position, though of course she doesn't show it, understandably enough. Instead, she usually complains and curses the post. But in secret, she is constantly observing the general mood. And so she saw that people were becoming indifferent, that they no longer thought it worthwhile to lift up their eyes when Frida came in, that even the domestics no longer bothered with her, but rather clung for understandable reasons to Olga and girls of that sort. And she also saw from the landlord's conduct that she was becoming less and less indispensable. One couldn't continue inventing new stories about Clam. There's a limit to everything. And so dear Frida decided to try something new. But who could possibly have seen through that right away? Peppy suspected it, but unfortunately she failed to see through it. Frida decided to create a scandal. She, Clam's mistress, would throw herself at the first comer, if possible at the lowest of the low. This would cause a stir, they would talk about it a long time, and finally they will once again remember what it means to be Clam's mistress, and what it means to reject this honour in the intoxication of a new love. The only difficulty was how to find the appropriate man with whom this clever game could be played. It couldn't be an acquaintance of Frida's, not even one of the domestics. He would probably have stared wide-eyed at her and gone his way. Above all else, he wouldn't have maintained sufficient seriousness, and it would have been impossible, even with the greatest eloquence, to spread the rumour that Frida had been accosted by him, hadn't been able to ward him off, and had, in a moment of oblivion, succumbed to him. And even if it had to be the lowest of the low, it still had to be someone of whom one could credibly claim that despite his dull and unrefined manner, he longed for nobody but Frida, and had no higher wish, good heavens, than to marry Frida. But if it had to be a common man, perhaps lower even than a labourer, far lower than a labourer, then he would still have to be a man who wouldn't make you the laughing stock of every girl, and might even seem attractive to some judicious girl. But where do you find a man like that? Another girl would probably have spent her entire life vainly looking for him. But Frida's good fortune guides the surveyor into the taproom, perhaps on the very evening that the plan first crosses her mind. The surveyor. So what is Kay thinking of? What extraordinary ideas go through his head? Is there something special that he wants to achieve? A good appointment? A prize? Does he want something of that sort? Well then, he should have gone about the whole thing very differently from the start. He is nothing, though. It's painful even to think about his situation. He's a surveyor. Perhaps that is something, since he has learned a trade, but if you don't have any idea what to do with it, it's still nothing. And he still makes demands. Without having the least bit of support, he makes demands. Not directly, but you can still see he's making certain demands, and naturally this is irritating enough. For did he not know that even a chambermaid demeans herself somewhat if she talks to him at any length? And then with all these special demands of his, on that very first evening he goes and falls into the crudest trap with a thud. So he is not ashamed of himself? Well, what was it about Frida that won him over? For he could own up to it now. Had she really succeeded in pleasing him, that thin, yellowish creature? Oh, no, he never even looked at her. She simply told him that she was Clam's mistress. That still struck him as a novelty at the time, and so he was lost. But then she had to move out. There was naturally no room for her at the gentleman's inn any more. Peppy saw her again the morning before the move. The staff had come running. Everybody was eager to get a look. And she still had such power that people pitied her. Everybody, even her enemies, pitied her. So that at the very beginning her calculation proved correct. Her having thrown herself away on a man such as that seemed incomprehensible to everyone, a stroke of fate. The little kitchen maids, who of course admire every barmaid, were inconsolable. Even Peppy was affected by it. Even she couldn't completely resist. though her attention was actually directed elsewhere. She noticed that Frida wasn't all that sad. But basically it was a terrible misfortune that had befallen her. She herself acted as though she were very unhappy, but that wasn't good enough. Peppy wouldn't allow herself to be deceived by that game. What kept her going? Perhaps the happiness of her new love? Well, there could be no question of that. But what else could it be? Where did she get the strength to be as coolly amicable as ever, even with Peppy, who was regarded as her successor? Peppy hadn't the time to think about all this just then. She had too much to do with the preparations for the new post. She was probably supposed to start in a few hours, and had no beautiful hairdo, no elegant dress, no fine underclothing, no serviceable shoes. All of that had to be put together in a few hours. If you could not fit yourself out properly, then it was better to relinquish the post entirely, for you would certainly lose it otherwise before half an hour had gone by. Well, she almost managed. She has a special talent for hairdressing. The landlady once asked her for a hairdo. It's a special nimbleness with her hands that has been given to her. But then her thick hair is easy to manage. For the dress, too, there was help at hand. Her two colleagues remained loyal to her. They regard it as something of an honour when a girl from within their own group becomes a barmaid, and besides, later on, if Peppy had gained power, she could have provided them with some advantages. One of the girls had left some precious material, her treasure, lying around for a long time. She had often let the others admire it, and probably dreamed of putting it to splendid use at some point. But then, and that was nicely done on her part, since Peppy needed it, she gave it up. And both of them helped her very eagerly with the sewing. Had they been sewing for themselves, they couldn't have shown greater zeal. It was even cheerful and gratifying work. They sat there, each on her own bed, one above the other, sewing and singing, passing the finished pieces and accessories up and down. When Peppy thinks about it, her heart grows even heavier at the thought that everything was in vain and that she is going back empty-handed to her friends. What a misfortune, and how frivolously it had been brought about, especially by Kay. How pleased everyone had been about the dress. It seemed a guarantee of success, and after it was finished and they found room for one small ribbon, the last doubts vanished. And isn't the dress really beautiful? It's already crushed and a little stained. Peppy didn't even have a second dress. She had to wear this one day and night. But you can still see how beautiful it is. It's something not even that accursed Barnabas woman could have come up with. And then the way you can draw it tight and loosen it again as you wish, at the top and the bottom, and the way, although it's only a dress, it can be so easily changed, was a particular advantage, and was actually something she had invented. Of course, she isn't difficult to sew for. Peppy wasn't boasting about this. Anything will look good on healthy young girls. It was far more difficult to get hold of underclothing and boots, and this actually is where the misfortune commences. Here, too, her girlfriends helped out as best they could, but they weren't able to do much. For it was only coarse underclothing that she gathered and sewed, and instead of boots with high heels, she had to make do with slippers, which you feel better hiding than showing. They consoled Peppy. After all, Frida didn't dress very prettily either, and traipsed about so sloppily at times that the guests would rather be served by the cellar boys than by her. That was true, but this was something Frida could permit herself, for she had already won favour and prestige. If at some point a lady shows up dirty and carelessly dressed, that only makes her all the more enticing. But what about a novice like Peppy? And in any case, Frida was completely incapable of dressing well. She's utterly lacking in taste. If a person happens to have yellowish skin, then she is, of course, stuck with it. She needn't, like Frida, deck herself out in a cream blouse with a low neckline and almost blind you with the sight of all that yellow. And even if that hadn't been so, she was really too stingy to dress well. Everything she earned, she held on to. Nobody knew what for. On duty, she didn't need money. She made do with lies and dodges. Peppy could not and would not follow this example. She was, therefore, justified in prettying herself in this way so as to show herself to her best advantage, especially at the start. Had she had great resources to draw on, she would, in spite of Frida's slyness, in spite of Kay's foolishness, have emerged the victor. Things certainly got off to a good start. She had already acquainted herself with the few little skills and bits of knowledge that were necessary. No sooner was she in the taproom than she had settled in. At work, nobody missed Frida. It wasn't until the second day that a number of guests asked where Frida was. There hadn't been any mistakes. The landlord was satisfied. On the first day, in his anxiety, he was always in the taproom. Later on, he came only now and then. And finally, since the cash book tallied, the receipts were even a little higher on average than in Frida's day, he handed everything over to Peppy. She came up with a few innovations. Frida had, not out of diligence, but rather out of stinginess, imperiousness, and fear of giving up her rights to others, supervised the domestics, to some extent anyhow, particularly when there was somebody looking. By contrast, Peppy assigned that entire task to the cellar boys, who are more adept at it. That way she could spend more time on the gentlemen's rooms. The guests were served quickly, but she could still say a few words to each one, unlike Frida, who claimed that she was reserving herself for Clam alone and took every word, every approach from other men to be an insult to Clam. But of course that was clever of her, for if she ever let anyone approach her, it was an enormous favour. But Peppy hates tricks like that, and in any case they're not useful when you're just starting there. Peppy was friendly to each of the customers, and each one repaid her with his friendliness. All of them were clearly pleased with the change. When the exhausted gentleman finally managed to sit down over beer for a moment, you can literally transform them with a glance or a shrug of the shoulders. So eagerly did all of them run their hands through Peppy's curls that she probably had to redo her hair 10 times a day. Nobody can resist the lure of these curls and bows, not even Kay, who is so absent-minded otherwise. And that's the way those exciting, strenuous but successful days flew by. If only they hadn't flown by so quickly, if only there had been a few more of them. 4 days are too few, even when you're exerting yourself to the point of exhaustion. Perhaps a 5th day would have been enough, but 4 days were too few. True, in those 4 days Peppy had found some patrons and friends. If she could have trusted all of the looks she was given every time she came in with mugs of beer, she would be awash in a sea of friendship. A clerk called Bratmeyer is crazy about her. He bestowed on her this small chain and a pendant, which he had put his portrait into. That certainly was cheeky of him. That and a few other things had happened, but still it had only been 4 days. But if Peppy put her mind to it, in 4 days Frida could almost be forgotten, though not completely. But she would have been forgotten all the same, perhaps even earlier, if she hadn't taken the precaution of putting her name on people's lips with her big scandal. In this way she had become a novelty to people, simply out of curiosity they would have liked to see her again. The very thing they had grown sick and tired of now held some attraction for them again, thanks to Kay, whom they regarded with utter indifference otherwise. Though they wouldn't have given up Peppy in exchange, so long as she was there making her presence felt in the taproom. But they are mostly older gentlemen, cumbersome in their habits. It does take a few days for them to get used to a new barmaid, no matter how advantageous the change may be. Quite against the wishes of the gentlemen themselves, it does take a few days, maybe only 5, but 4 aren't enough, for despite everything they regarded Peppy merely as a temporary. And then possibly the greatest misfortune, that in those 4 days, Clam, even though he had been in the village those first 2 days, didn't come down to the public room. Had he come, that would have been the decisive test for Peppy. A test, incidentally, that she was least afraid of, and even looked forward to. She wouldn't, but of course it's best not to go near matters like that with words, wouldn't have become Clam's mistress, and wouldn't have lied her way up to a position like that, but she could have put the beer glass down on the table at least as nicely as Frida had done, could have welcomed the guests in a pleasant manner, and taken leave of them just as pleasantly, without any of Frida's pushiness. And if Clam ever looks for anything in a girl's eyes, then Peppy's eyes would have completely satisfied him. But why did he not come? By chance? Peppy had even believed that at the time. During those 2 days she expected him any moment, and even during the night she waited for him. No Clam will come, she thought constantly, running back and forth simply out of restless expectation and the wish to be the first to see him the moment he came. This constant disappointment made her tired. Perhaps that's why she did not accomplish as much as she might have accomplished. When she had the time, she sneaked up to the corridor, which the staff is strictly forbidden to enter, squeezed into an alcove, and waited. If Clam would only come, she thought. If only I could take the gentleman out of his room and carry him in my arms down to the public room. I wouldn't collapse under the burden, no matter how big it was. But he did not come. In those corridors upstairs it's so silent, one cannot imagine it if one hasn't been there. It's so silent that one cannot stand it there for long. The silence drives one away. Again and again, 10 times, Peppy was driven away, but 10 times she went back up. That was quite pointless. If Clam wanted to come, then he would come. But if he did not want to come, Peppy would not entice him out, even though with her pounding heart she was almost suffocating in the alcove. It was pointless. But if he didn't come, then almost everything else was pointless, too. And he did not come. Peppy now knows why Clam didn't come. Frida would have been wonderfully amused had she been able to see Peppy in the alcove in the corridor, with both hands on her heart. Clam didn't come down because Frida wouldn't let him. It wasn't through her pleas that she had accomplished this. Her pleas don't reach Clam. But she, the spider, has connections nobody knows anything about. When Peppy says something to a guest, she says it openly. The next table can hear. Frida has nothing to say to them. She puts the beer on the table and leaves. All one can hear is the rustling of her silk petticoat, the only thing she spends money on. But when she does say something, she does not do so openly. She whispers it to the guest, bending down so that the people at the next table prick up their ears. The things she says are probably quite trivial, but not always. She does have connections, uses some to support others, and if most of them lead nowhere, who would want to have to bother about Frida all the time? One or the other of those connections does work. And she now began to exploit these connections. Kay gave her the opportunity to do so. Instead of sitting with her and keeping watch over her, he hardly ever stays at home, wanders about, has discussions here and there, is attentive to everything, not only to Frida, and in order to give her even more freedom, moves from the bridge inn into the empty schoolhouse. What a wonderful way to begin a honeymoon. Well, Peppy is certainly the last one who will reproach Kay for not being able to stand being with Frida. One simply cannot stand being with her. But then why hasn't he left her altogether? Why has he gone back to her again and again? Why has he created the impression through his wanderings that he is fighting for her? It even looked as if it was only through his contact with Frida that he had discovered his actual paltriness, and in an effort to make himself worthy of Frida and somehow claw his way to the top, had abandoned their life together temporarily, but only in order to be able to make up later on for the privations without being disturbed. Meanwhile, Frida loses no time. She sits in the schoolhouse, to which she probably steered Kay, and observes the gentleman's inn, and observes Kay. She has excellent messengers at hand, namely Kay's assistants, whom Kay, this is incomprehensible, even if you know Kay, it's incomprehensible, leaves entirely to her. She sends them to her old friends, reawakens their memories of her, complains of being held captive by a man such as Kay, agitates against Peppy, announces she'll soon be back, asks for help, begs them not to reveal anything to Clam, acts as though Clam has to be protected and can therefore on no account be allowed down to the taproom. What to some she makes out to be a consideration for Clam, she uses with the landlord as an example of her success, pointing out that Clam doesn't come down any more. How could he come if the person serving in the taproom is only a Peppy? True, it isn't the landlord's fault, for this Peppy was the best replacement he was able to find, only she won't do, not even for a few days. Kay knows nothing about all these activities of Frida's. When he's not wandering about, he lies at her feet, unawares, while she counts the hours that keep her from the taproom. But the assistants do more than carry messages. They also serve to make Kay jealous and to keep his blood warm. Frida has known the assistants since childhood. They certainly don't have secrets to keep from one another any more. But in Kay's honour they begin to long for each other, and the danger arising for Kay is that this will turn into a great love. And Kay does everything Frida wants, even the most contradictory things, allows himself to become jealous because of the assistants, but permits the three of them to stay together while he wanders off on his own. It's almost as if he were Frida's third assistant. Finally, Frida decides, on the strength of her observations, to strike a great blow. She decides to return. And it actually is high time for that. It's admirable how this sly Frida senses it and takes advantage of it. Frida's inimitable skill lies in her powers of observation and resolve. If Peppy had that, how different her life would be. Had Frida only stayed in the schoolhouse another day or two, Peppy cannot be driven out, is a barmaid for good, loved and kept by all, has earned enough money to add some splendid things to her meagre wardrobe, and in another day or two, Clam can no longer be kept from the public room by means of intrigue, comes, drinks, feels comfortable, and, if he even notices Frida's absence, he is extremely pleased with the change. Another day or two and Frida, with her scandal, her connections, the assistance, all of that is completely forgotten. She's never mentioned again. Then she might cling to Kay all the more tightly, and might, if she were capable of this, truly learn to love him? No, that wouldn't happen either. For even Kay doesn't need more than a day to become tired of her, and to recognize how dreadfully she deceives him in everything, her so-called beauty, her so-called fidelity, and most of all her so-called love of Clam. Only one day more, that's all it takes for him to chase her and that whole filthy assistant mess from the house. Even Kay doesn't need any more than that. And just then, between these two dangers, when the grave is beginning to close above her, Kay, in his simple-mindedness, keeps the last narrow path open for her. Just then she takes to her heels. All of a sudden, and this is something hardly anybody was expecting any more, it goes against nature, all of a sudden it is she who is pushing away Kay, who still loves her and constantly pursues her. And it is she who, with some helpful pressure from friends and assistants, appears to the landlord as a saviour, all the more enticing owing to her scandal. Desired by the lowest as well as the highest, as has been proved, but who was only enthralled with the lowest for a moment and soon pushed him away, as is only fitting, and is as unattainable for him and for everyone else as she used to be. Except that earlier one had just doubted all this, but now one had been persuaded again. So she returns. The landlord, with a side glance at Peppy, hesitates. Should he sacrifice the barmaid who proved her worth? But he's soon persuaded. So much speaks in favour of Frida, especially since she'll woo Clam back to the public rooms. And now it's already evening. Peppy won't wait until Frida comes and makes a triumphant show out of taking on the post. She has already handed over the cash book to the landlady. She can leave. The bed compartment in the chambermaid's room downstairs is prepared for her. She will go down, be greeted by her tearful friends, rip the dress from her body, the ribbons from her hair, and stuff everything into a corner where it is well hidden and doesn't needlessly remind her of times that ought to be forgotten. Then she will take the big bucket and the broom, clench her teeth, and get down to work. But first she had to tell all this to Kay, who even now couldn't have made this out without some help, so that he for once would see clearly how horribly he has treated Peppy and how unhappy he has made her. Of course he, too, has been subjected to nothing but mistreatment. Peppy had finished. Breathing deeply, she wiped a few tears from her eyes and cheeks and looked at Kay, nodding her head as though she wanted to say that this had really nothing at all to do with her misfortune. She would bear it and did not need help or consolation from anybody, least of all from Kay, for she knew a great deal about life, despite her youth, and her misfortune only confirmed her knowledge, but it certainly had to do with Kay. She had wanted to hold a mirror up to him, and even after all her hopes had been dashed, she had thought it was still necessary to do so. "What a wild imagination you have, Peppy," said Kay. "It's not at all true that you've only just discovered all this. Those are only dreams from your dark, narrow chambermaid's room downstairs, which are not out of place there, but here in the public tap-room they sound odd. You couldn't make your mark here with ideas like that. Well, that's quite understandable. Even the dress and hairdo you boast about are nothing but the evil spawn of that darkness and of those beds in your room. They're no doubt all very fine down there, but here everyone laughs at them, secretly or openly. And what else were you saying, that I was mistreated and deceived? No, dear Peppy, I was as little mistreated and deceived as you were. It's true, for the moment Frida has left me, or has, as you put it, taken to her heels with an assistant, you have certainly caught a glimmer of the truth. And it is also really quite unlikely that she will ever become my wife. But it is absolutely untrue that I would have grown tired of her, let alone that I would have driven her away the very next day, or indeed that she would have deceived me, as otherwise a woman might deceive a man. You chambermaids are used to spying through a keyhole, and so from the tiny details that you actually see, you often draw grand but false conclusions about the whole thing. The result is that, for example, in this case, I know far less than you do. I certainly cannot give as detailed an explanation as you can of the reasons why Frida left me. The most likely explanation, it seems to me, is the one you mentioned but didn't use, namely my neglect of her. That's unfortunately true. I did neglect her. But there were specific reasons for that which are irrelevant here. I would be happy if she returned, but then I would immediately start neglecting her again. That's how it is. When she was with me, I was always away on those wanderings that you ridicule. Now that she's gone, I have almost nothing to do, am tired, and I desire to have even less to do. Don't you have any advice for me, Peppy? Oh, yes, said Peppy, becoming animated all of a sudden and seizing Kay by the shoulder. Both of us were deceived. Let's stay together. Come on down with me to the girls. So long as you complain about being deceived, said Kay, I cannot reach an understanding with you. You're constantly wishing to have been deceived because it's flattering and because it moves you. But the truth is that you aren't suited for that position. How clear that unsuitability must be if even I, the most ignorant person in your opinion, can see it. You're a good girl, Peppy, but it isn't so easy to see that. I, for one, initially considered you cruel and arrogant, but you're not. You're simply confused by this position, which confuses you because you aren't suited to it. I don't want to say that the position is too lofty for you. It's really not such an exceptional position. But looked at more closely, perhaps it is somewhat more honourable than your previous position. But on the whole, there is no great difference. The two are really confusingly similar. One could almost claim that it would be preferable to be a chambermaid rather than serve in the taproom, for one is always surrounded by secretaries there, while here, though one may serve the superiors of the secretaries in the public rooms, one must waste one's time with the lowest riffraff, like me, for instance. By rights, I'm not allowed to spend my time anywhere except here in the taproom, so is it such an enormous honour to associate with me? Well, it seems so to you, and you may have your reasons for that. But that's why you are unsuitable. It's a position like any other. But to you it is heaven, so you seize everything with exaggerated eagerness and pretty yourself just as, in your opinion, the angels pretty themselves. But in reality they're different. You tremble for the position, feel you're constantly being hounded, seek to win over through exaggerated friendliness everyone who could, to your mind, support you. But you only disturb and disgust them, for what they want at the inn is peace, and not the barmaid's worries on top of their own worries. It is possible that after Frida's departure, none of the high-ranking guests noticed what had happened, but today they know it and really long for Frida, since Frida must have managed everything quite differently. No matter how she is otherwise, and no matter how high a regard she had for her position, on duty she was highly experienced, cool and restrained. You even stress that yourself, though you obviously haven't learned anything from the example. Did you ever notice that look of hers? That surely was no longer the look of a barmaid. It was almost the look of a landlady. That look of hers swept over everything, but also took in each person, and the glance accorded to each one was still sufficiently strong to conquer him. Who cares that perhaps she was rather thin, rather old, that one could imagine more plentiful hair? Those are trifles compared with what she really had in her possession, and anybody who found these shortcomings disturbing would simply have demonstrated his incapacity to appreciate higher things. One certainly cannot reproach Clam for that. It's only because of your mistaken point of view as an inexperienced young girl that you cannot believe in Clam's love for Frida. To you, Clam seems unattainable, and rightly so. You therefore think Frida couldn't have approached Clam either. You are mistaken. On this question, I would rely solely on Frida's word, even if I didn't have unmistakable proof. No matter how unbelievable this may seem to you, and no matter how difficult it may be for you to reconcile it with your notions of the world, of officialdom, of refinement, and of the effect of female beauty, it is true all the same that just as we sit here and I take your hand in mine, they sat there side by side, Clam and Frida, as if it were the most natural thing in the world. And he came down here of his own free will, even hurried down. Nobody was lying in wait for him in the corridor and leaving other tasks undone. Clam himself had to go to the trouble of coming down, and the defects in Frida's clothing that would have horrified you did not disturb him at all. You don't want to believe her, and you don't realize how you're exposing yourself and the lack of experience you are revealing in this way. Even someone who knew nothing of her relationship with Clam would certainly have to recognize by observing her nature that it had been molded by someone who was more than you and me and all of the people in the village, and that the conversations between them went beyond the jokes that go back and forth between guests and waitresses and that seem to be your goal in life. But I'm being unjust toward you. You do recognize Frida's good qualities yourself, only you're interpreting everything incorrectly. You think she's simply using all of this for her own purposes and to some evil end, or even as a weapon against you. No, Peppy, even if she had arrows like that, she could not shoot them at such close range. And selfish? One could rather say that by sacrificing the things she already owned and the things she might have expected to gain, she gave the two of us the chance to prove ourselves in a higher position. But we have disappointed her, and we're even forcing her to come back. I don't know whether that is so, nor am I certain of my guilt. It's only when I compare myself with you that such things come to mind. It is as if both of us had struggled too hard, too noisily, too childishly, too naively to obtain something that can be easily and imperceptibly gained through, say, Frida's tranquility and Frida's reserve, and had done so by weeping, scratching and tugging, just as a child tugs at the tablecloth but doesn't gain anything and only tears down all that splendour and puts it out of his reach forever. I don't know whether that is so, but I certainly do know that it's more like that than as you say. Oh, well, said Peppy, you're in love with Frida because she ran away from you. It's not hard to be in love with her when she's gone. But even if everything is as you would have it, and even if all this, even your ridicule of me, is justified, what are you going to do now? Frida has left you. Neither my explanation nor yours gives you any hope that she'll return. And even if she does, in the meantime you'll have to stay somewhere. It's cold, and you don't have work or a bed. So come to us. You'll like my friends. We'll make you comfortable. You'll help us with our work, which is really too heavy for girls to do on their own. We girls won't have to fend for ourselves any more, and we will no longer be afraid at night. Come to us. My friends know Frida too. We'll tell you stories about her until you have grown tired of them. Do come. We have pictures of Frida too, and we'll show them to you. In those days, Frida was even more unassuming than she is now. You'll barely recognize her, at most by her eyes, which had a sly expression even then. So will you come? Is that permitted? Yesterday there was, after all, a big scandal because I was caught in your corridor. Because you were caught. But when you are with us, you won't be caught. Nobody will know about you, except for the three of us. Oh, it'll be fun. Life there now seems more bearable to me than it did only a moment ago. Perhaps I won't even lose that much by having to go away from here. Listen, Even with only the three of us, we weren't bored. One must sweeten the bitterness of life. It's already been made bitter for us in our youth to ensure that our tongues don't get spoiled. The three of us stick together. We live as pleasantly as possible there. You will like Henriette in particular, but Emily too. I have already told them about you. There one listens to such stories with incredulity, as though nothing could ever happen outside that room. It's warm and narrow, and we huddle all the more closely. No, even though we depend on each other, we haven't become tired of each other. On the contrary, whenever I think of my friends, I'm almost glad to be returning. Why should I climb any higher than they? That's precisely what kept us together, that for all three of us the future was blocked off in the same way. But then I broke through and was separated from them. I didn't forget them, of course, and my first concern was how to help them. My own position was still uncertain. I had no idea just how uncertain. And it wasn't long before I talked to the landlord and Henriette and Emily. Concerning Henriette, the landlord wasn't altogether intransigent. But for Emily, who's much older than the two of us, she's about Frida's age, he held out no hope. But, believe it or not, they have no wish to leave. They know the life that they're leading there is miserable, but they've already reconciled themselves to it, the dear souls. I think their tears over my departure were mostly out of grief that I had to leave the room we share and go out into the cold. There, everything outside the room seemed cold, and that I had to cope with strange, tall people in strange, tall rooms for the sole purpose of making a living, which, after all, I had been doing quite successfully in our common household. They probably won't be at all astonished when I return, and will weep for a while and bewail my fate only so as to let me have my way. But then they'll see you, and realize that it was actually a good thing that I went off. It'll make them happy to see that we now have a man who will help us and protect us, and they'll simply be delighted that all this must be kept secret, and that through this secret we will be bound together even more closely than we were before. Come, oh please come to us. There will be no obligation. You won't be confined to our room all the time, as we are. Then, when spring comes and you find a refuge somewhere else and don't like being with us any more, you can, of course, leave. But even then you must keep this secret and not give us away, since that would be our last hour at the Gentleman's Inn. And in other ways, too, you must naturally be careful while you are with us and not go showing yourself anywhere, unless we've said that there's no danger there. And in general, you must follow our advice. That's the only thing that binds you, and surely you're just as keen about this as we are. But otherwise you're completely free. The work we'll assign you won't be too difficult. You need have no fear of that. So will you come?
How much longer is it till spring? Asked Kay.
Till spring? Repeated Peppy. The winter here is long, a very long winter, and monotonous. But we don't complain about that down there. We're safe from the winter. Of course, at some point spring does come, and summer too, and they certainly have their day. But in one's memory, spring and summer seem so short, as if they didn't last much longer than 2 days, and sometimes, even on these days, throughout the most beautiful day, snow falls.
Just then the door opened. Peppy gave a start. Her thoughts had strayed too far from the taproom. But it was not Frida. It was the landlady. She feigned surprise on finding Kay still here. Kay excused himself by saying that he had been waiting for the landlady. He also thanked her for the permission he had been given to spend the night here. The landlady could not understand why Kay had waited for her. Kay said he had the impression that the landlady wanted to say something else to him, and he begged her pardon if he had been mistaken. Besides, he had to leave. He had left the school, where he was janitor, to its own devices for too long. That summons yesterday was to blame for everything. He didn't have enough experience in such matters yet. It would certainly never happen again. Never again would he create unpleasantness for the landlady, like yesterday. And he bowed with the intention of leaving. The landlady gazed at Kay as if she were dreaming. Her gaze detained Kay longer than he had intended, and now she was even smiling a little, having only just been awakened, as it were, by the astonished expression on Kay's face. It was as though she were expecting an answer to her smile, and woke up only because the answer failed to come. "Yesterday, I think it was, you were so cheeky as to say something about my dress." Kay couldn't remember. "You cannot remember? Cheekiness is often followed by cowardice." Kay excused himself. Yesterday he had been tired, and might have said something like that. In any case, he couldn't remember any more. Besides, what could he have said about the landlady's clothes? That they were so beautiful that he had never before seen anything like them. At any rate, he had never seen a landlady working in such clothes.
"Stop making comments like that," the landlady said quickly. "I do not want to hear another word from you about the clothes. My clothes are of no concern of yours. I forbid you to talk about them, once and for all."
Kay bowed again and went to the door.
"Well, what does that mean?" the landlady called after him, "that you've never seen a landlady working in such clothes? What's the point of senseless comments like that?
That makes no sense at all. What are you trying to say? Kay turned around and asked the landlady not to get upset. Of course, it was a pointless comment. Besides, he knew absolutely nothing about clothes. In the situation he was in, every clean, unpatched dress seemed valuable to him. He had simply been surprised to see the landlady appear at night in the corridor in such a beautiful evening dress among all those barely dressed men, that was all. "Well then," said the landlady, "you finally seem to have remembered the comment you made yesterday, and now you're topping it off with some more nonsense. As for your not knowing anything about clothes, that is true. But in that case, and I am requesting this of you in all seriousness, do also refrain from passing judgment on the valuableness of clothes or the inappropriateness of evening dresses and so on. Besides," it was as if a cold shudder went running through her, "you may have nothing to do with my clothes, do you hear?" And since Kay was about to turn away again without saying a word, she asked, "So where did you acquire your knowledge of clothes?" Kay shrugged and said that he had no such knowledge. "You have no such knowledge," said the landlady. "Then you shouldn't act as though you do. Come to the office. I'll show you something, and then you will, I hope, cease being cheeky for good." She went through the door first. Peppy leaped over to Kay. Under the pretext of settling Kay's account, they quickly reached agreement. This was quite easy, since Kay knew the courtyard, which had a gate leading into the side street. By the gate was a small door behind which Peppy would be standing in about an hour, and which she would open on the third knock. The private office was opposite the taproom. All he had to do now was cross the corridor. The landlady already stood in the illuminated office, looking impatiently in Kay's direction. But there was another interruption. Gerstecker had been waiting in the corridor and wanted to speak to Kay. It wasn't easy to shake him off. Even the landlady helped out by chiding Gerstecker for his intrusiveness. "So where to? Where to?" Gerstecker could still be heard calling, even after the door had been closed, and his words were disagreeably interspersed with sighs and coughs. It was a small, overheated room. By the end walls were a reading stand and an iron safe, along the side walls a cabinet and an ottoman. Most of the room was occupied by the cabinet, which not only took up the entire side wall, but was so deep that it made the room much narrower. Three sliding doors were needed to open it completely. The landlady pointed to the ottoman. Kay should take a seat. She herself sat on the swivel chair by the desk. "Have you never even learned anything about clothes making?" asked the landlady. "No, never," said Kay. "Well then, what are you?" "A surveyor." "And what's that?" Kay explained. The explanation made her yawn. "You're not telling the truth. So why aren't you telling the truth?"
"You are not either."
"I'm not?"
"You're becoming cheeky again. And even if I weren't telling the truth, must I answer to you?
And in what way am I not telling the truth?"
"You are not only a landlady, as you claim."
"Look here, you're full of discoveries. So what else am I? But your cheekiness is really getting out of hand."
"I don't know what else you are. I can see only that you are a landlady, and besides that you are wearing clothes which aren't suitable for a landlady, and which, so far as I know, no one else in the village wears."
"Well then, we finally are getting to the heart of the matter. You cannot even conceal it. Perhaps you are not cheeky. You are like a child who knows some silly thing and cannot be kept silent. So speak. What's special about these clothes?"
"You'll be angry if I tell you."
"No, I shall laugh. It'll be nothing but childish talk. What kind of clothes are they?"
"So you do want to know? Well, they are made of good material, quite costly, but they are outmoded, overdone. They've been frequently altered, are worn out, and aren't suitable for your age, your figure, or your position. They struck me at once when I first saw you. It was about a week ago, here in the corridor."
"Oh, so that's it then. They're outmoded, overdone. And what else? And how do you come to know all this?"
"I can see it. No training is required."
"So you can see it that easily? You do not need to ask. You simply know immediately what fashion demands. Then you will become indispensable to me, since I do have a weakness for beautiful clothes. And now what will you say once you see that the wardrobe here is full of clothes?"
She pushed aside the sliding doors. One could see the dresses pressed tightly together throughout the length and breadth of the wardrobe. They were mostly dark-coloured, grey, brown, or black dresses. All of them had been carefully hung up and spread out.
"These are my dresses. They are all, in your opinion, outmoded and overdone. But these are simply the dresses I have no space for in my room upstairs. I have two more full wardrobes there. Two wardrobes, each one almost as large as this one here. You are amazed?"
"No. I was expecting something like that, for, as I said, you are not only a landlady, you have other goals."
"My only goal is to dress beautifully, and you are a fool, or a child, or a very malicious, dangerous person. Off with you now. Kay was already in the corridor, and Gerstecker had again caught hold of his sleeve when the landlady called after him, I am getting a new dress tomorrow. Perhaps I shall send for you. Gerstecker, waving his hand angrily, as if determined to silence from afar the landlady who was bothering him, asked Kay to go with him. Initially, he refused to give any further explanation. He paid scarcely any attention to Kay's objection that he needed to go to the school. Only when Kay began to resist being dragged did Gerstecker tell him that he shouldn't worry, that he would be given everything he needed at his house, that he could give up his position as school janitor, but should finally come. He had spent all day waiting for him. His mother had no idea where he was. Gradually giving way to him, Kay asked what he wanted in return for food and lodgings. Gerstecker gave only a cursory answer. He needed Kay's help with the horses. He himself now had other business, but Kay shouldn't let himself be dragged along like this and make things needlessly difficult for him. If he wanted to be paid, he would be paid. But Kay now came to a halt, despite all the dragging. He didn't know anything at all about horses. That wasn't necessary, Gerstecker said impatiently, clasping his hands angrily in order to induce Kay to go with him. I know why you want to take me with you, Kay said finally. What Kay knew was of no concern to Gerstecker. Because you think I can get something out of Erlanger for you. Certainly, said Gerstecker. Why else would I be interested in you? Kay laughed, took Gerstecker's arm, and let himself be led through the darkness. The room in Gerstecker's cottage was only dimly illuminated by the fire in the hearth and by a candle stump in the light of which someone deep inside an alcove sat bent under the crooked, protruding beams reading a book. It was Gerstecker's mother. She held out her trembling hand to Kay and had him sit down beside her. She spoke with great difficulty. It was difficult to understand her, but what she said... This concludes the reading of The Castle by Franz Kafka. This book was read by Jeffrey Howard. If you would like to obtain a mail-order catalogue or additional information about our growing line of audiobooks, write Blackstone Audiobooks, Post Office Box 969, Ashland, Oregon, zip code 97520, or call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. Thank you.